you have any embarrassing relatives in your wider family? Are you an embarrassing relative in your wider family? Do you have any famous relatives in your wider family going back into your ancestry? I'm actually married to a descendant of Håkon Håkonsson, the king of Norway, 1217 to 1263. That's my claim to fame. Generally, though, in modern American culture at least, it seems that family pedigree is no longer very important to people. It once was, and still is in so many other cultures. Family pedigree is hugely important in the Bible, not only in the Old Covenant, but also in the New, as we will see today. We come to the seventh and last sermon in the first circle of sermons on the book of Ruth. We are at the end of the story in chapter 4 at the epilogue. If you're using a Pew Bible, it's on page 416. 416. Turn to it with me. Here we will see that God demonstrates himself to his people to be the one who, by the power of redemption, he reverses the misfortunes of those who trust him, elevating them by restoring to them what they had lost or never had. That's who God is. And so we should expect him to demonstrate himself to be the one who shows to his people, to be the one who reverses their misfortunes by the power of redemption. All those who trust him, he elevates them, and he does it by restoring to them what they had lost or never had. Do you feel this morning keenly the pain of loss or misfortune of some kind, broken relationships, maybe ill health, wasted years? Have you been longing? And all of us should be longing for the reversal of every difficult loss and deprivation in our lives. Well, if you are longing for that, take heart, because God intends to encourage you with this story this morning. The end of the story of Ruth in the fourth chapter. And we come to verse 4 here. We can't tell the whole story again, but remember that Boaz, who is a relative of Naomi's and Ruth's, has been asked by Ruth to marry her. And he tells her that there is a man before him, a relative closer to him, who has the opportunity and responsibility to redeem the family. That's the structure in the Old Testament law for prevention of poverty. And so that land stays in the same family, that if a man dies, his brother was socially and morally obligated to take his brother's widow and to marry her in order that she might raise up offspring, that the land might remain in the family. Well, Boaz calls a little court in session, and this fellow who is before him, he sees him coming along, and so he stops and he asks him whether he will in fact fulfill his obligation to redeem. And he doesn't. So Boaz steps up to the plate and does. And we begin reading at verse 9 of chapter 4. Here in 8, this kinsman redeemer has said to Boaz, "I'm out, buy it yourself." And then he removes his sandal. That was the formal ceremony to seal a contract. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses. Then the elders and all those at the gate said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. It's a name that means servant. He was the father of Jesse, Jesse the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon, Salmon the father of Boaz, Boaz the father of Obed, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David, the great king. So far the reading of God's word. The kinsman redeemer redeems. And what a reversal of fortune follows. For all three of the characters in the story, Naomi, she gets a grandson, and her husband's land stays in the family. Naomi also gets a wealthy son-in-law, which moves her out of poverty and out of social and economic vulnerability. Ruth gets a husband and moves from being an outsider immigrant. She moves from being way down on the social scale where the lower servants are. She moves up to a position of influence and security as she takes over. A la Proverbs 31, management of the household of one of the most honored and influential men in the community. Now, not as his servant, but as his wife. And then she gets to what she never got with her first husband, Mahlon. She gets a child. And Boaz, he, having been widowed or perhaps never married, a man who had been alone, now has a wife of remarkable character, much younger than him, full of humility, full of loyalty, full of devotion to God. And Boaz, too, gets what he didn't have, an heir, a son, now in his older years, to carry on the family line, the family wealth, the family heritage, the family land. So God gave back to these three from whom so much had been taken or never given. He gave them back the rich blessings of marriage, family, community, prosperity, honor, and influence. They who had lost much were given back much. They who had lived with disgrace were promoted to places of honor. They who were low were raised high by their Father in heaven who loved them. Because behind the economic upturn, stimulated by the high yield of the barley and wheat crops that year in Bethlehem, behind that there moved the sovereign hand of God. And so we read in verse 6 of chapter 1, when Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people, by providing food for them, she prepared to return home. Behind the sexual intimacy by which a son was born to Ruth and Boaz, there moved the sovereign hand of God. And so we read in verse 13 that we just heard, and the Lord enabled Ruth to conceive. Behind the very human choice of Boaz, who had to think about whether or not he was going to take on the responsibility and the cost of redeeming this family, behind that very human choice of Boaz to be Elimelech's kinsman redeemer, there moved the sovereign hand of the great redeemer God of Abraham. And so in Boaz's blessing on Ruth in verse 12 of chapter 2, we read, "May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." God loves, and so he redeems. He brings back that which was lost. God is the God of the great reversal. So Hannah celebrated when the Lord broke the cycle of barrenness and gave her a son, Samuel, who would become a great prophet. Hannah prayed, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord my horn is lifted high. For I delight in your deliverance, O God. The bows of the warriors are broken, but those who stumbled are armed with strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for food, but those who were hungry hunger no more. She who was barren has borne 7 children, but she who has had many sons pines away. The Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor because he is the God of the great reversal." That's who he is. And even in the blessings pronounced on Ruth and Boaz there that we just heard at the end of the official court proceedings in the city gate, even their allusion is made to God as the God of great reversals. Look at verse 11. "Then the elders and all those at the gate said, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel.'" Some of you know the story of Rachel and Leah, 2 sons of Jacob. Jacob loved Rachel, the younger daughter, but Rachel's father Laban tricked him into marrying Leah, Rachel's older sister. A week later, Laban gave his daughter Rachel to Jacob, and he took her as his second wife. But we read this in Genesis 29, and Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. The book of Genesis is frank about the fact that Rachel was more attractive than her sister Leah. But why are we not surprised to read this in Genesis? When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he opened her womb. But Rachel was barren. Now, Rachel would eventually bear 2 sons, but Leah bore 6 sons to her husband Jacob. And it was through Judah, Leah's son, and not Rachel's, that the great prince David would come, and later the Messiah himself, Jesus. And look at the last blessing that someone pronounces on Boaz before everybody went home that day. It's in verse 12. "Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." Now, who is Tamar and Judah and Perez? It's a remarkable story. It is parallel to the Ruth Boaz story because it had to do also with the responsibility that a man had to marry his brother's wife if his brother died, so as to raise up an heir for his brother. You can read about it in Genesis 38 this week. It's a fairly long story, but the upshot of it is this: becoming frustrated with her father-in-law, Judah, who has no intention of giving his third son to her after he gave her the second son, because his first son died while he was married to Tamar. The second son refused to give Tamar and his older brother an heir and pretended only to sleep with Tamar. Well, he died also. And Judah wasn't about to lose the third son, and so he lied essentially to Tamar and said he would give her the third son when he grew up. But Tamar eventually sees that she has been played, and so she poses secretly as a prostitute. She snags Judah, her father-in-law, and keeps something of his to prove that she slept with him. And she gets pregnant. What happens? Well, out rolls all the hypocritical indignation of men who so often live with a double standard for men and women when it comes to sexual purity. 3 months after the incident, people tell Judah, "Your daughter-in-law is pregnant." Well, Judah, zealous for the justice of God, so he thinks, calls for the death penalty. But as she is being brought to a public place where they are going to burn her to death, she produces the staff and the cord and the seal that was precious to every businessman in Israel, in the ancient world, in fact. And she says, "I'm pregnant by the man who owns these. You recognize him?" And Judah is cut to the heart. He's much chastened, as he has been caught red-handed, and he proclaims, "She is more righteous than I am." Well, having played the prostitute, as it were, she gives birth, and she has twins. And the first one out is Perez. And that's who Boaz is descended from, the man born of a union between a woman and her father-in-law. Now, how would you like to have somebody like that in your family tree? But that's the line that God chooses to be the ancestry of the great King David and of great David's greater son, Jesus Christ. Why? Because he is the God of the great reversal. He is the God who, quote, chose the lowly things of this world and the despised, as the Apostle Paul puts it, to shame the morally self-righteous, the respectable, the condescending and the pretentious, the self-reliant in this world. It is the broken and the twisted, the weak, and the spent, and the marginalized that God came to offer himself to as a great kinsman redeemer, as one who could reverse misfortune, who could redeem, that is, who could buy back, who could make the weak strong, and the last first. Matthew, in his gospel, mentions only 4 women in the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah. And 3 of the 4 are either explicitly mentioned in the book of Ruth or indirectly alluded to. There is Ruth, who is a foreigner. There is Tamar, who is a foreigner and who resorted to sexual subterfuge to get an heir. And there is Rahab, who is also a foreigner, almost certainly the prostitute from Jericho. who seems to have been converted to the living God, and whom Matthew identifies as the wife of Salmon, who is mentioned here in verse 21 of chapter 4 as the father of Boaz, probably not the immediate, certainly not the immediate father, it was too far back, but a direct ancestor of Boaz. Because those who are low on the totem pole, God has the power to honor and to lift up. He is the God of the great reversal. So what is the meaning of this story for us? Come to God, the God of the great reversal, and he will turn around all your losses, and he will bless you with a spouse and with children, with land, with prosperity, and a place of honor in the community. Is that what we are to get? Last week I heard the sad story of a Christian couple whose teenage son accidentally ran over his 5-year-old sister with a car and killed her. Now, how is God, as the great kinsman redeemer of his people, going to work a great reversal in a situation like that? And besides, perhaps you're thinking, all this stuff about the land, all this stuff about children and family pedigree, all that disappeared, did it not? With the ending of the old covenant, God hasn't really promised those things to me. He hasn't really promised them to you, has he? Actually, he has. Family pedigree is as important in the new covenant as it was under the old. You cannot even get into the kingdom of God unless you can demonstrate that you are descended from Abraham. You can't get in. But descended how? Not by blood, by biological descent, but by faith. And so Paul wrote to the Galatians, and he wants them to be crystal clear. Understand then that those who believe are descendants of Abraham. Well, what about the land? Why was it, in fact, so important that these little barley fields that had belonged to Elimelech and the fields that his sons would inherit, why was it so important that they stay in the family line? Well, it was to underscore something. It was to underscore for a Christian family living in a shack in Bangalore in the 21st century, or for a Christian widow living in New York City and just barely able to pay rent on her apartment. It was to underscore for them and for every believer in Jesus Christ, in every age and in every place, that no matter how low they are on the social scale, no matter what they have lost, no matter how little they own, in due time, they will get what Abraham and his descendants were really promised in the promise of the land. And we learn it in Romans 4. They will inherit the whole world and all of its richness. Heidi has already alluded to it this morning. That will happen when Jesus comes. And God can promise that, because he is the God of the great reversal. And when he gives himself to his people, then those who have little, measured by human standards, have everything. No wonder then that when Isaiah foretells the days of the coming Messiah, he does it by picturing a most dramatic reversal. Sing, O barren woman. who never bore a child, burst into song, shout for joy, you who were never in labor, because more are the children of the desolate woman than of her who has a husband. That's the great reversal. And if you read the prophets, if you read the Old Testament, even the New Testament, and you're looking for that theme of God turning around loss and deprivation and low standing, it is there in so many different places. Listen to this. I've read this before, but I never thought of this quote in connection with the book of Ruth, which is a remarkable story of redemption, of having that which was lost or never enjoyed restored. That's from Tom Howard. He is summarizing, he is pulling together all that the scriptures teach about what it means that God has become our kinsman. He has become one of us. Jesus was our brother. Why? In order to redeem us. I announce to you redemption. Behold, I make all things new. Behold, I do what cannot be done. I restore the years that the locusts and worms have eaten. I restore the years which you have drooped away upon your crutches and in your wheelchair. I restore the symphonies and operas which your deaf ears have never really heard, and the snowy peaks your blind eyes have never seen, and the freedom lost to you through plunder, and the identity lost to you because of false accusations and the failure of justice. And I restore the good which your own foolish mistakes have cheated you of. And I bring you to the love of which all other loves speak, the love which is joy and beauty, and which you have sought in a thousand streets, and for which you have wept and clawed your pillow. Friend, your life and mine is a theater in which God is proving that he can and will do just that. And if we are faithful, in due time we will know beyond the shadow of any doubt that he is the one who, by the power that he has to redeem what was lost, that redeeming power that he worked in our kinsman redeemer Jesus, will in fact reverse all of our misfortunes, all of our losses, and he will elevate us, restoring what went through our fingers, giving to us what we never had. He gives himself, first of all. That's the core of the covenant. The promise of the land is there. And in the new heavens and the new earth, all of God's people will inherit that. And the promise of children is there. It's important. And all of the sons and daughters of Abraham and Sarah are regarded as one big family. And even those who do not have biological children, even those who have not been able to adopt children, can still be spiritual mothers and fathers. That's all part of what life under the new covenant means now. That is all there. But the core is, I will be your God, and you will be my people. The one who has God has everything. However rich, however poor, the one who has God has everything. He is a great redeemer. And that's why we love him. That's why we trust him. That's why we have put everything on the line, waiting for that day when, as Paul says, our faith will be vindicated and we will be seen not to have been fools, to put our trust and confidence in the one who says, I will restore the years that the locusts have eaten.